Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hey, friends, happy Friday Junior this Thursday afternoon and a gorgeous sunny day here in Chicago. And the weather is just going to keep on improving all the way through the weekend. That is really good news. Just so nice to see the sun. And joining us here for the first segment of the Wintrust Business Lunch, by the way, it's John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand today. And tomorrow, then, Steve will be back next Monday, is Nick Heineman, the Executive Director of Social Works. Nick, thanks for joining us here on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. And just to correct you real quick, Director of Programming of Social Works, our excellent Executive Director, Justin Cunningham, couldn't make it.
Okay, sounds good. Yep. All right, so Social Works, for those of people that don't know, they've probably heard about it through many news outlets with what Chance the Rapper is doing. Walk us through what Social Works is.
Yeah, Social Works is a Chicago-based nonprofit founded by Chance the Rapper, Essence Smith, and Justin Cunningham. And what Social Works aims to do on a daily basis is create equitable opportunities, but more so a pathway where a youth, an adult, or anybody could find their creative selves with opportunity.
And how involved is Chance? Because, you know, some people start, you know, nonprofits, or they start these things and they kind of step away. But from what you've been telling me before we went on the air, Chance is quite literally really involved in this project, not only in the operation of it, but the little things too.
Absolutely. From ideation, big picture, to logistics, to hands and hustle on the groundwork. Chancellor has been a great help to us as a leader, but more so to all of our volunteers in the moment, you know, carrying chairs to set up for an event and helping with donations as well.
So you just had an event last month, Night at the Museum. Talk us through how that went and what it was all about.
Absolutely. Thank you. A Night at the Museum is a part of Social Works' Warmest Winter Initiative. It's a night that's meant to inspire thoughtfulness and unity in the city while providing a donation hub. So we ask everybody to, you know, walk away from the screens for a night and come together. We celebrated at the Museum of Science and Industry this year. We had about 9,000 people come up and provide thousands of donations with you know, over 70 community partners that came out to make it kind of like a street fair in the museum, and it was a great time.
And you guys got tons of donations, thousands of donations, and you literally have to carry that stuff around you. I mean, like, that's just the way it is. I mean, you guys are a small operation.
Yep, we are still grassroots. Social Works is three people deep, and we have great help from our volunteers and collaborators. The donations themselves were, hundreds of very heavy bags that took a lot of really dedicated volunteers, and again, that hands and hustle that we look for.
And you guys have a really cool event coming up that you've just made sure that we can talk about, right?
Absolutely.
Tell us through. This is a really great concept.
So, you know, we have a lot of support from our community, but more so we're looking to make sure that everything we do comes full circle. So with the Night at the Museum, we're looking to aid those who are experiencing homelessness, both in immediate relief and long-lasting and sustained relief. So Social Works can now announce that we will be holding Taste for the Homeless with the Chicago Park District here at the end of January. It's going to be an event where all of our donations from a Night at the Museum come to fruition, but more importantly, we're creating an event experience for those who experience homelessness.
Where was the inspiration behind it? I mean, obviously, Taste for the Homeless has an obvious play on the Taste of Chicago, right?
Sure, yeah. A Taste for the Chicago is a great event that the city values, but what isn't valued is those who are hungriest. So what we're doing here is making sure that outside of just the food and the warming items, we provide an experience, entertainment, a concert, socialization, as well as professional development with job skills.
Yeah, I've been, you know, I work over at WCIU as well, and here, and there's so many great events and outreach programs, whether it's you know, shelters or kitchens and stuff. And the conversation that always kind of runs through all those things is that the biggest gift that we can give people that are a little underserved is the sense of dignity and empowerment in who they are. That by providing not only just the food for, you know, them for the day or whatever it might be, the entertainment, the fact that they can feel like the rest of us, which they are, just like the empowerment sense that they can get from a night of entertainment and fun too.
Yeah, and that playing field is not even, thank you for mentioning that, because, you know, there's certainly an inhibitance to feel a belonging to society when you're not experiencing what society has to offer. And that, of course, is outside of the daily liberty of being fed and feeling safe.
We got to take a quick commercial break, but I'd love to chat about My State of Mind, which is a really great part of Social Works. Oh, 720 WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand today, tomorrow again, but Steve will be back on next Monday. All right, Nick Heineman, Director of Programming for Social Works, joining me on 720 WGN and Instagram Live.
And
you're
Instagram
all over
Instagram Live, yeah. You know, this is a time for really engaging the community in Chicago, so we'll do it however we can.
Okay, so we were talking about Social Works, how it got started, but not only do you guys kind of have these broad goals, which I think are important, you do like to dive into certain specific areas, and I think it was at the summit in October that Chance made the announcement that he really wanted and wanted you all to focus on as well. The mental health situation in Cook County, which has gone through a lot of interesting phases over the last few years. A lot of funding
sure.
has been decimated in that area. So talk us through what My State of Mind is.
Yeah, My State of Mind was kind of birthed out of the idea that we do bring ourselves into a whole realm of societal supports that we're trying to enhance. And with everything that we do to inspire creativity and to build dreams and everybody, letting them be themselves, mental health and mental wellness can be the first inhibitor of being successful. And obviously, you know, if mental health was as far reaching as other forms of health, we wouldn't see what we're seeing. But My State of Mind will unify the broader mental health community. It will increase the access of visibility and services in Cook County, and it's going to make it admirable just to start to be honest with ourselves again. This initiative that it really just comes and will thrive off of input from the community at large, consumers and practitioners alike.
So breaking those down a little bit, I think that last one you mentioned about the idea of being honest about mental health, being okay to kind of get away that stigma that if something's not quite right, to talk about it openly, and that's the best way moving forward. How do you do that? I mean, people talk about that all the time, of breaking down the stigma or trying to, you know, make it okay to feel certain different ways and to speak that. How do you actually communicate that to the youth and young adults of our city?
Yeah, the solution to breaking the stigma isn't something we claim to have an absolute answer for, but we certainly know that it's based off of premise of both systemic issues as well as cultural issues. So with My State of Mind, we're doing a couple things. First, by unifying, we championed hitting the reset button on mental health collaboration mm-hmm. here in the city of Chicago and Cook County. So we got public, private, and state practitioners to come together and unify for the first time. We are engaging the public, and then we're also starting to expand the definition of mental wellness resources themselves. So we're going to build a guidebook, and we're going to give out some grants.
That's a real tangible thing. I like that, a guidebook, because really I think that when people, you know, are encountering a problem in their mental health, they may not know the resources that are available to them. Or, I mean, there's really no map, a roadmap on where to go.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the collective pool of resources here in Cook County are vast and they're diverse. But the problem is what we define as a mental wellness or mental health service provider needs a little bit of adapting. So what My State of Mind is doing in its most significant push is to collect service providers that range on that clinical side from psychiatric services and therapy, but more importantly, come back down to a side of socialization, creativity, embracing each other for who we are. And those are done in settings all over Chicago, creative workshops, as well as businesses that offer some sort of way to feel better. But people might not think of them that way.
So when you say guidebook, are you talking about like an actual physical booklet that'll be handed out or around the city?
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about that. But more importantly, we're talking about a digital revolution yeah. in the mental wellness and mental health guidebook field. We will be creating in-print versions of our guidebook that are applicable to the constituents who need them. But excitingly, we are building an online digital space where our resources will be managed, but more importantly, the user experience will be like unlike anything you've seen before. You're going to see a little bit of familiarity from your social media. You're going to see a little familiarity from different apps that help you sort out where you're trying to go and what you're trying to do. Most importantly, we're going to enhance it with a social media network where people can collaborate, communicate, both as consumers and practitioners.
So when you say that you unified for the first time these sort of different services, what did that look like? Is that getting everyone to sit down and in a summit sort of way? Is it about just laying out everything that everyone does? What do you mean by unifying everyone together?
Yeah, the My State of Mind cohort, as we'll call it, is the first time that our regulatory institutions of health and mental health in Illinois have sat at the table. So our cohort we formed is the Illinois Department of Human Services, the Cook County Department of Public Health, the Cook County Department of Health, formerly Health and Hospital Systems, the Juvenile Protective Association, as well as individual practitioners. So we took groups that are usually working in a siloed fashion, mm-hmm. apart from each other, and started to say, hey, when we're all at the table as thought leaders, but more so with social works, driving home this infrastructure of a guidebook, that people suddenly got remotivated to say, hey, collaboration is endless when it comes to mental health.
Yeah, you imagine connecting dots is a really important thing, especially when we're talking about such an important issue. So was it just like real, was it inspiring to have people sit down and talk about their goals and how they might align and be able to be allies with each other? Is that what kind of came, one of the positive things that came out from that summit?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that is a huge effect of what the cohort has done, is allowed others to realize that they do have similar interests. But more importantly, Social Works has found ourselves in a spot now that we didn't want to disrespect the past. And we wanted to make sure that those who have been working on this their entire lives could be ushered into a new culture and atmosphere where new approaches aren't looked down upon, but they're embraced. And ours isn't that complicated. It's just basically saying that these collection of resources that are only clinical-based scare some people and doesn't allow them to take that first step in their wellness journey.
And you guys are also giving away some grants, right, to providers?
Absolutely. It is still, submissions are still open at socialworkshy.org. We are giving away six $100,000 grants. What's interesting about these, and again, how Social Works is kind of changing the landscape, is that these are operational-based grants. We're not going to pigeonhole you into a corner and say, we need to see this program and this results. What we're doing is saying, what would your dream programming or any kind of enhancement to the operational structure of you as a service provider, how would that look with $100,000? Because we know the ideas are good, it's the capital and the support that's lacking.
Social Works as a whole, if people are listening to this, want to get involved, what's the best way to do it?
The best way to get involved is to follow us on social media. You can follow us at socialworks_shy, C-H-I, socialworks_shy, and online at socialworksshy.org.
You got that all memorized, man. You got that whole spiel ready to go. Nick, good luck with everything, all right?
Appreciate the time today. Thanks for having us.
Before we get to news, a little news as well. I talked to this before the air. You know, Chance the Rapper is like such an iconic part of the city and in so many ways. I mean, the millions that he's given and the causes he's been about. The only way he could be any cooler is if he was a superhero. And it turns out he was. This incredible story of him rescuing someone from a car and someone had seen it and he never publicized it. I mean, is that just kind of who he is?
Yeah, I would say that, and not to comment on that directly because I wasn't there, but if Chance the Rapper is around and you need help, most likely you're going to get it.
Cool stuff. Nick, thanks so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand today and tomorrow. Steve will be back on Monday. Dennis Rockin always stops by to talk about real estate from Crane Chicago Business. Dennis, how you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I love your shirt today. I know you didn't expect me to say that on air, and I know it's radio, but if you go to the stream, you can tell it's a great shirt.
Thank you very much. It was a gift. I get them. I wear some loud shirts. It's
true. I like it.
But they're good for radio. They show up well.
They really do. Okay, let's talk. Let's jump right in. I didn't realize that Muhammad Ali had a footprint in terms of real estate anywhere near the Chicagoland area. He doesn't anymore, but in the Southwest Michigan property just sold, right?
He did. Yeah, he had it for over 40 years until his death, and his widow just sold it just before Christmas. He was living here in Chicago in the early 70s, mm-hmm. bought this former church camp. It had been a lot of things on a bend in the river in Berrien Springs, beautiful 81-acre place. Ali's biographer, Jonathan Eig, a Chicago journalist, told me that he did a lot of training there, but it was mostly sort of the day-to-day. It wasn't any major. Mm-hmm. He didn't do any major training. But he did buy it at the same year he did the Thrilla. He fought the Thrilla in Manila.
Wow.
That gives you an idea of the time frame.
Yeah.
And kept it, though he moved to Los Angeles and later to Arizona, kept it all that time. And according to Jonathan Eig, actually used the property until about 2006 when, as a lot of people know, his health started to decline.
But still, all the way till 2006, still coming to Southwest Michigan.
Yeah, one of his sons went to the schools in that area and that sort of thing. And the family continued to use it after he could no longer. He really is connected to Berrien Springs, about 90 minutes from when he bought it. He was living in Kenwood, and it's about a 90-minute drive from there. And just before Christmas, his widow sold it.
Yeah, I look at the asking price originally, and I say, that's an odd number, $2,895,037. But there's meaning there.
Yeah, the 37 at the end represents the 37 knockouts in his career.
And they've sold for $2.5 million. If I'm the guy who bought it, the guy or gal who bought it, you got to add $37 at the end of that, right?
You know, Come on. What the agent told me is, yeah, so the buyers were a foundation based out of New York, and they offered $2.5 million and $37, but the paperwork came out to just $2.5. But it's a nice tribute. They did, however, they also bought the statue of Muhammad Ali separately that was on the property.
I got a question about properties like this where celebrities have lived or owned or visited. Do those typically get a little bit more in the market, or is it such a niche thing that it really doesn't garner much more in terms of asking or of retail price?
I have two words.
Okay.
Michael Jordan.
Fair enough.
I think that answers your question.
Yeah.
No, they don't. I think celebrity properties get a lot of buzz. They, I write about them. A lot of other people in Chicago write about Chicago celebrities and all around the country selling their properties. But it doesn't tend to really do much good.
Yeah, I think someone's going for memorabilia if they really love that, you know, celebrity or something. They're not going to just buy their property for some sort of a value that, you know, some sort of a homage to them or anything like
that. Yeah, I think those in Los Angeles where a series of movie stars, you know, somebody lived here in the 30s and the 50s and the 70s. Different stars have all lived here. Then a little bit more cachet attaches to it. But here, it's really more for the, I hate to say it because I'm in the business of doing it, but it's the buzz that it generates.
Let's go up to Glencoe. The Hoover Estate sells for over $10 million. This is not only important because it's a lot of money, but what they're going to do with the property is interesting. And also it marks a new level of $10 million homes sold in a year, right?
This is kind of amazing. Yeah, that is. So it sold in 2018, though we're in 2019 now. It sold December 28th, and it is the seventh property in the Chicago area in 2018 to sell for $10 million or more. We've never had that many. The most we've ever had was six in 2015. In most years, including 2015 and 16, 2016 and 17, we've had two sales at $10 million or more. This is a lot. Seven properties at $10 million or more, several on, in the suburbs and in the city. And that sort of attaches to that upper end, which has been unbelievably active. I don't have my year-end totals nailed down yet because some properties will still come in, but it looks as if there are 72 properties in the region that sold for $4 million or more. Compared to 46 a year ago.
Oh, wow.
So up more than 50% from 2017 to 2018.
Is there anything we can say about those upper level things that reflect the larger market? I mean, obviously, that would happen in a broader sense, a better market than other years. I know that, and we'll talk a little bit more about Chicago, specifically about the market cooling off. I mean, I guess for when you're talking that high end level, you're not seeing much of a dip, and you wouldn't see much of a dip for at least a little bit later.
Well, so there are three factors, and I'll make them fast. One is stock market wealth of the past year. One is that these upper-end buyers are getting a lot more for their money here than in other cities. Sure. If I buy a $10 million condo in Chicago, I get a whole lot more than if I buy a $10 million
condo. Are you going to buy one?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm the $10 million.
Oh, there you go.
You get a heck of a lot more.
You were just trying to get it to the new record this year.
Exactly.
So you could write about it.
I wanted to finally cover my own purchase. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So a lot of it is they know that spending $10 million here really gets them a heck of a lot more than in Palm Springs, Florida, Denver, Vail, all those kinds of places where they have second homes. And the third factor is one particular building, number 9 Walton, which is the one where Ken Griffin, a billionaire, bought in 2017, and many others have bought so far in 2018. There are still some to close in 2019. But of those 72, I don't recall the number, but it's more than 20 are at that building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's those three. Those are the main three factors for it being such a boom year at the top of the market.
This Hoover Estate has a long history to it as well.
It does. It's a long history, but with only one family. So it was farm until the early 1920s, approximately 1920. And then Earl Hoover bought actually multiple farms, built the mansion, the 10,000 square foot mansion. He died in the 1980s. His widow, who was either his second or third wife, I don't recall, but younger than he, just died in 2018. And so the property was in his or his widow's hands from the early 1920s until
last week.
Longevity there. Yeah. And the property is over 12 acres. They're going to split it on up, right?
They're going to divide it up. Yeah. So this is actually, I talked about stock market wealth, et cetera. This is not one of those, really, because this is developers. I don't yet know who, but they're planning to divide it up. They almost certainly will tear down the house. So the house will have had one owner for about 99 years and be gone. Big 10,000 square foot Tudor house sort of in the middle of the property. And from what I hear, though nothing's confirmed yet, because I don't know who the buyers are, they're not in the public records yet, looks like about two dozen houses built on that 12 acres, probably sort of empty nester, you know, one story kind of thing, which is something that Glencoe doesn't have a lot of.
Really? So the need is there. All right. Dennis Rockin, real estate reporter at Crane Chicago Business. Stay here because we're going to talk about, I find this one fascinating. There's been an unfinished property.
Yeah.
For 30 years.
One of my most, yeah, I think that's a fascinating story too.
That'll be after the break here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. I'd say we're still in the window of looking back on 2018 and wondering what we can learn from it all. And thankfully, the Chicago Tribune shared their 2018 list of most influential business people in Chicago. And it's a great mix of big and little influencers. Just a few of them are Helen Gay, CEO of Chicago Community Trust, Paul Gossett, the CEO of Jewel Osco, and Betsy Ziegler, the CEO of 1871. I think it's pretty safe to say it was a monumental year for Chicago business, so it's appropriate to pat ourselves on the back and recognize greatness. And, okay, I just really wanted to share this one. TSA has announced that they're training more floppy-eared dogs to join their security team because apparently people find pointy-eared dogs more intimidating. Yeah. Of the 1,200 dogs employed right now, around 80% are floppy-eared, and they're looking to increase that. You know, sometimes these are the business decisions you have to make. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
720 WGN, Dennis Rockin from Crane's Chicago Business, just putting me at ease about the place that I bought a little while ago. Thanks for talking me through that.
You're welcome, my son.
And I keep on mentioning this to Ben. I hope he's okay me mentioning this there, but we both bought condos this past year, our first time buying, which is always something you're jumping into. It's a little bit risky. And of course, the market has cooled off a little bit, the stock market specifically. And housing markets across the country have softened a bit. How are we doing in Chicago?
We haven't softened yet. But there's a reason we haven't saw. I mean, at the upper end, things are, I talked about some super fabulous sales, but up in the million to two, 3 million range, they've slowed down quite a bit. But in general, our market has, we have the advantage of not having been white hot the last few years. So the Seattles, the Portlands, the San Franciscos, where prices were going up in the double digits, 10, 11, 12, in some cases, 14%. They have started to cool in part because prices went up so fast that affordability disappeared and people said, you know, they either pulled back or they bought less house or whatever it was. And then so the combination of that and rising interest rates really cooled down those markets. We've been rising in a very steady way, far more modestly. I was just using numbers like 10, 11, 12. We've been in the 3% range. We are generally, we're the, of the top 20 cities, we're at the back, the 17th through 20th city on the list for slow growth. And that's been true for a couple of years. That's not easy if you're a homeowner already wanting to sell because your value isn't coming back. You may not have the cash, you may not pull out of it the cash that you need to buy the next home. But it's great if you're a buyer like yourself, because it means that affordability isn't disappearing quickly.
Yeah, and even I understand your point about people that are looking to sell. They want to see that 8% jump over a year and really, you know, capitalize on that. But from the general state of how things are, I imagine that officials, leaders, real estate, slow and steady is okay. I mean, it's kind of a sweet spot, right?
I would say we're just below the sweet spot, though, because one of the problems is we have been rising so modestly for so long. According to the Case-Shiller index, our home values are still down 16% from where they were at the housing, at the peak of housing. So if you bought before 2006, you may still owe more on your house, or you may still, your house may not be worth what it was then. While nationally home values are up more than 11% above the peak, so there's almost there's like a 25 percentage point difference between the nation and where we are. So we're not quite, we're a little below the sweet spot. It would be nice if we had been appreciating
more.
Mm-hmm.
But given what's happening now in those other cities, I'd say we're pretty okay.
Okay, let's. That you're making me feel good. Okay, so a Lou penthouse with killer views is, you know, the headline to this story. But the interesting part of the story is it's a top floor unit in a building here downtown that hadn't been it was left unfinished.
Yeah,
and unfinished for almost 30 years.
Yeah,
we don't quite know why, do we?
I cannot find out why. The building was built in 1989. It's 200 North Dearborn. If people know where the Goodman Theater is,
mm-hmm.
it's just north of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was an apartment building. It was the first high-rise residential building built in the Loop. It was the first residential building built in the Loop in generations, but the first ever high-rise. This is long before Millennium Park. This is before the Renaissance in downtown living. It was before all these condos. Virtually nobody lived in the Loop, and some developers took a flyer on this whole North Loop redevelopment that was happening at that time, started with Mayor Byrne and moved forward. Let's get rid of some of the grime in the North Loop. Put up an apartment building, and on the 47th floor, the top floor, just left it empty. Don't know why. It later went to another owner, owned the building, was converting the apartments to rentals. I'm sorry, converting the apartments to condos, the rentals to for sale condos. And I went up there. This was 2011, and they took me up there, and they said, yeah, this is just empty. There were boxes piled there.
Like an attic.
Yeah, it was an attic for a 47th floor attic, a little more than 3,000 square feet. Nobody knows why it was left empty. But at that time, the owners, 2011, were trying to sell it to somebody who'd turn it into a condo.
Mm-hmm.
It took 7 years. Early in 2018, a guy who thought he could make it work bought it, and he has. You can see from those photos, he's made it work. It's pretty sharp. It's got, from the condo itself, it's got remarkable views, and then it's got the entire rooftop of the building, and the views from there are just, I mean,
wait,
it's...
private rooftop then? Access
yeah.
to it?
The rooftop is approximately the same size as the condo.
And it's all for the person that lives there?
All for them, yeah. You have a staircase, nobody else has access, and views in all four directions, views north over the river, east and southeast, all the way to the lake, west over the Thompson building, that weird glassy uh-huh. top of the Thompson building, south to high rises. It's you're like sitting in an eagle's nest in
yep.
the, not in the middle of the Loop, but surrounded by building high rises in the Loop.
Yeah, I could have been there in all this time. I would
yeah.
have been fine with the boxes, too.
I
just move them out of the way and I just sleep in a corner somewhere.
I have an attic if you want to move in there, Jonathan.
Dennis Rockin, appreciate it. Where can people find out more information about you and all these great stories?
ChicagoBusiness.com.
Have a good one, okay?
Thanks.